From Directions Magazine, this is Directions on the News for Tuesday, September 2nd, 2014. This weekly podcast gives you an inside edge on technology news related to all things location. This is Joe Francica, Editor-in-Chief in Hightstown, New Jersey.
And this is Adina Schutzberg, Executive Editor in Somerville, Massachusetts.
We often discuss how geospatial technologies are disruptive to other businesses, but what might disrupt the geospatial technology sector? Are there technologies, business models, or something else that might have an impact how geospatial companies make decisions? We'll tackle that and more, but first a word from our sponsor.
Directions Magazine is the leader in geospatial technology webinars. If your organization is interested in more sales leads, stronger brand awareness, and positioning your company as a key thought leader, then let us help you deliver a professionally produced live event that reaches a global audience. For more information on both our 30 and 60-minute webinar formats, go to www.geospatialwebinars.com.
Adina, the term disruptive technology may have been coined by Clayton Christensen of the Harvard Business School, but the idea of disruptive technology goes way back, even so far as when trains replaced stagecoaches and Model T replaced horses, if you want to extrapolate that far back. Maybe an example perhaps more relevant to the software industry is would be when Windows, for example, was disruptive to command line driven software and spawned user interfaces. Certainly mobile devices have impacted us in so many areas, in particular software development, cloud storage, social media. All of these things have been somewhat disruptive. What's been the impact to the geospatial technology sector specifically? I believe there are other factors, other influences that we need to pay attention to. And in today's discussion, I want to reference a report from PricewaterhouseCoopers, the IT consulting company that identified trends that influence technology company business decisions. Now, there have been technology innovations that have certainly altered business models, but my opinion is that we're at an inflection point where innovations outside and inside our sector are having a more radical impact, and it's causing geospatial technology providers to react. So what I want to do is, you and I have chosen a few areas where we think disruption is occurring. So I want to start with sensors. I look at aerial sensors, mobile sensors, wearables, even fixed position sensors. You'll hear the concept, and this is new to me, but I'm sure others have heard of the concept of the digital sixth sense. These are devices that will understand our needs and, of course, understand our proximity. Paul Jacobs, the CEO of Qualcomm, expresses this in a video that we've posted to the show notes. I'm really intrigued by sensors and beacon technology, and specifically something that Qualcomm has called Qualcomm Gimbal. And that's a platform from Qualcomm offering context awareness and integrating beacon technology. Now, what this and other sensors have done, I think, is forced geospatial technology companies to think more about how we've become a platform as opposed to an isolated solution. And as such, interoperability with sensors is becoming more important as we try to capture location-based data and integrate sensor technology with software solutions. So that's where I'm coming from. That's kind of my first disruptive area that I wanted to put out there.
I also had sensors on my list, and this discussion of interoperability with sensors, it's all sort of coming together at this moment in 2014, but the OGC has been talking about sensors and sensor web for 15 years.
Yeah, sensor web enablement. Right. Yeah, and sweet stuff.
And honestly, that was sort of ahead of its time because the sensors were just like baby sensors then, right?
Right.
And the volume of data was very small then. And this idea of finding existing in situ sensors that were already out in the world and capturing the data was a discussion point. Now, the data that we're sensing is on those phones and on those quantified self wristbands that everybody wears.
Right.
Right. So I don't think we were imagining what kinds of sensors we had when we were thinking about that 20 years ago.
No, I think you're right. Yeah, and I think we give some credit to Dr. Mike Botz, who's head of the sensor ML and sensor web enablement initiative at the OGC.
And has been working on this since
for a long time.
I'm sure. Yeah. Now the other side to this, though is, you know, we're sort of doing this you know, 15, 20 year, you know, before time and now. The other thing that's really changing, and this is very important in this sort of data explosion, you know, we have all this data, we have all these sensors, is that a whole other kind of data that we're used to collecting is no longer available. Or if it is available, it isn't the same kind of data. And specifically, this whole idea of doing a survey where you call someone on the phone. And the most recent employment data just came out in the United States. And one of the caveats, according to one of the fellows from the New York Times, is back in the day when they called you on your home phone and said, would you like to take a survey? Are you working? Blah, blah, blah. You were much more likely to answer it. Now, your cell phone rings. You see that it's an 888 number. You don't even answer the phone.
No.
Right? So it's an interesting time that we have all of this sense data, but we're not getting some of this other data. And it means that we've got to be very clever about how we find sort of stand-ins for that data that we can no longer collect because people are not participating in the way that they used to.
And do you think, though, that some of this is automatically being captured, though, that because we are sharing some of this data, that maybe there isn't the need to do the traditional sense of market research?
I think we have to be very clever about how we get at it. So, for example, if somebody decides to share their location with their cell provider or with a particular brand or even maybe with the government for some reason that makes sense, and you find out that, yes, 5 days a week at 8 o'clock they go to the office or to some location that has an office in it and they come back at 5 o'clock, you might be able to decide, yes, in fact, they have a full-time job.
Yeah.
Now, if, in fact, that location that they go to every day is the library, you might think they work at the library, or maybe they're working on finding a job at the library, right?
That's right.
So it's hard, but I think some of the stuff can be extracted.
The next thing I wanted to talk about is more internal to our industry. And I've always had the impression that geospatial technologists have been divided into two camps, right? The vector world and those that play with satellite imagery in the raster world. I think we've been living mostly in the vector world, and now raster is a more disruptive influence that we've yet to understand more completely. Now, let's take, as an example, advanced spatial statistics. The data input to spatial statistics is generally points, lines, and polygons, vector data. At least that's my opinion. Data from social media is primarily point data from mobile devices, and we're getting tons of it, but soon there will be a flood of satellite sensors. I know we've talked about this before, but this thing is going to cascade like a huge waterfall of raster data. How many companies are prepared to process and interpret these data? Few, if any, right? It's going to be pixel mania out there, and somebody will have to find a way to process information more quickly, automatically extract data, and suggest viable information that creates alerts. For example, like, hey, this agricultural crop signature changed. Better put more fertilizer here today or in 3 days. And to me, that's going to be derived from raster data. So I think the raster data that will be coming more available is just going to change things. And I'm not sure we're prepared for it.
No, and I think there's actually a pretty decent parallel between 15 years ago, we were getting ready for sensors.
Mm-hmm.
And 15 years ago, we had some imagery, right? But we didn't know what to do with it. Well, now we have even more imagery, and hopefully we're finding more of those processes, again, to turn that raw data into information that is data in context such that we can take action.
Absolutely.
And I think we're really in a very similar place. What do we do with all this sensor data, and what do we do with all this other kind of sensor data that's coming from satellite images?
And that's going to go back to our other point, which is how do we interoperate this data? How do we integrate this data? And both sensor and raster data are going to be used as inputs to decision making.
I think we're further along with the interoperability side there. So I want to take a little turn towards education. I think education is disrupting things, and I want to, and from the business standpoint, in a very specific way. So it used to be when you wanted to hire somebody, they need to have a bachelor's degree in some discipline that you've heard of, like chemistry or mathematics or statistics or something. Now, education is such a mishmash of experiences and degrees and certificates and badges and videos and portfolios and that it's almost impossible to set requirements for what this person must do or what certificate they must have. So this whole process of how do we evaluate these newly formed professionals and decide whether or not they should come to work at our company is really I think it's making people crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do you have to figure out which ones you want to interview based on that collection of credentials, formal or informal, that they have, then you've got to figure out how to evaluate them in terms of are they the right one for the job. And it's not as simple as saying, well, can you program in this language? Because, of course, next week we're going to be using a different language. So we're looking for a whole different set of skills, so we need a new rubric against which to measure them. And I think that's really throwing organizations for a loop.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. So it almost makes the concept of what did you major in obsolete.
I think we're getting closer and closer to that all the time.
Well, I think the opportunity to develop a different grouping of skill sets to enter the marketplace, whether you focused your concentration on English or chemistry, is allowing students to develop those skills. It's just the opportunity to do more and absorb more, I think, is presenting a different skill set to the workforce, creating probably a real headache for the HR people.
I think it really is.
The last thing I'll focus on is augmented reality. Now, I think AR was very overhyped in the beginning. That's probably an understatement. And I think what we are now seeing are more practical applications, hypermodels for infrastructure development and visualization is one of those things that's coming to the forefront. Bentley Systems has been demonstrating this for a few years. What intrigues me about being able to visualize the actual 3D models in real space, you know, in real space, not virtual space, is intriguing to me. So what if you could take image processing, for example? They're doing CAD and 3D models, but from my point of view, what if you could take in image processing data to something like using Google Glass to help field biologists and geologists conduct ground truth by projecting classified imagery, now that we've got sub-meter accuracy, through a Google Glass to see radiometric differences of plants and trees, or even merely projecting a geologic map through a tablet to learn geology. I think it's time. I think maybe these are some of the more practical applications that we see for AR. I would love to see them implemented because, again, I go back to the implication of having all of this raster data available. Wouldn't it be cool to see processed imagery through a Google Glass or a tablet projected onto a field of corn or a stand of Doug fir trees?
Two things. Yes, I do agree that augmented reality was really overly hyped. When I was teaching, I suggested to my students that it was a solution in search of a problem.
All right.
And they pretty much agreed with me. This is five or so years ago. Tell me what a hypermodel is.
Bentley describes these hypermodels as it's more of a 3D model that is projected onto real space. For example, if you were looking at a pavement, a street, for example, what they're doing is projecting the subsurface infrastructure into a augmented reality environment. So you may be looking through a tablet and you see the subsurface design projected in real space, for example. So they call it hypermodel.
It sounds just like regular augmented reality.
Augmented reality, right. I think that maybe they've adopted that. I really like what they've done. I think it's a cool way of visualizing. But it is AR in the basics.
We keep coming back to this theme. We've got all this data. We've got new ways to visualize it, new tools to look through the tablet or look through the Google, use the Google Glass to enhance the experience. We're figuring it out what to do with it. We're slowly moving from a solution in search of a problem to actually using it as a real solution to a real problem.
Helping people. You know, it really is a help to people.
It is, but it's still, we're really on that cutting edge. In fact, in the show notes, there is an interview I did with a professor at Vanderbilt who was sort of on the cutting edge of this. And we've really got to change the way we think about augmented reality. Now, the last thing that I want to talk about goes back to social media. Issue here is that social media has really changed the conversation in pretty much every part of our lives, personal and professional. And I want to zero in on one particular part of that conversation. And let me quote, this is from a podcast, part of the For Immediate Release podcast network called For Immediate Release Business to Business, B2B. And highly recommended. I have learned quite a lot from that. And one of the very first episodes of the podcast, one of the hosts made the comment that the buyers are having a learning party and the salespeople are not invited, which really blew my mind. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that that was actually a very accurate statement, because when you're interested in purchasing a solution, you might go to the homepage just to find out what the offerings are, but then you immediately go to your peers, typically via social media, and say, hey, what's your experience? What works? What doesn't work? And there are so many different places to have that conversation where the vendor may or may not be, that, again, the people who are offering these products and services really have to find a new way to communicate with the people who are having the learning party and getting ready to buy. So it means that they need to change what they used to do before, which was send us emails and send us brochures in the mail and invite us to their conferences and so forth. And now they've got to do different things, and they're starting to do that. So while ESRI still does a lot of those traditional things, you're also seeing its name pop up at hackathons, and you're seeing it participate in social media in different ways. In fact, ESRI also has hosted its own platform for communication, GeoNet. Users are expecting more transparency. We want the vendor to be part of the conversation and not come after us as the, I'm going to beat you over the head until you buy my product. That's got to change. I think that whole change of how the buyers are buying and the process they go through and how they're using social media is really changing how these organizations have to communicate.
Yeah, it's changed the communication pathways in many respects. Advertising and those forms of communicating information to the prospective client is changing radically. And it's what you have always said, you know, and what we've seen is that every company has to be a media company. So these new forms of communication have to be established. Well, that's all the time we have for today. And from us here at Directions, we have some very informative webinars coming up. This week in particular, we have Making Location Work for Smart Cities, the Case for Location Standards, sponsored by the Open Geospatial Consortium on September 3rd, followed by Learning Open Web Mapping from Start to Finish, sponsored by Penn State on September 4th. For more details, go to directionsmag.com/webinars. If you'd like to comment about today's podcast, you can write to us at editors@directionsmag.com. Leave a comment where this is posted on Directions Mag, or send us a tweet at Directions Mag. Thanks again for joining us today, and be sure to tell a friend.